Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Coffee and Open Source, a place to meet some new friends, have some great conversations, and maybe learn something along the way. I'm your host, Isaac Levin. And if you're enjoying the conversations here, be sure to like, subscribe, follow wherever watching or listening. Also, if you or anybody you know would be interested in coming on chatting with me, feel free to reach out to me on Twitter. My handle there is Isaac R. Levin, or you can reach out to me on Mastodon. My handle there is Isaac R. Levin at fossendon.org. All right, I'm looking forward to this one. We talked for way too long before we got started, you know, did a little bit of warm up, and, but I think we're going to have a lot of stuff to talk about still. And I'm looking forward to the chat with my guest today, Justin Garrison. Justin, do you want to say hello? Introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hey, Isaac. Thanks for having me on. I'm currently the director of DevRel at Sidero Labs.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to chatting. And I think the best way to ever start a conversation with somebody you don't really know a ton about or haven't had a lot of conversation with is like learning where it all started. Like, do you recall like when technology became a thing for you? Like, when you realized that it was something you kind of wanted to mess around with, learn more about?
Technology wasn't a part of my life, like for most of it. It wasn't like a big thing. I never had a computer growing up. I had a typewriter in high school. And the only reason we bought a computer was because our typewriter broke and we couldn't okay. repair it. And I was just like, I had to like in high school, we had to type our papers. And I was like, I would literally type on a typewriter. And then it broke. A friend gave us an old computer. I didn't really know how to use it. I remember having Net Zero was like, we had internet because we could have Net Zero, but it wasn't like a thing. Like I didn't need it. We had one phone line. It wasn't like, it was like, oh, this computer sits in the corner, but I just type my papers on it. So I took typing classes, but that was about as far as I got into technology, all the way up moving to college. And I moved to college and I didn't have a computer. And I was just like, I'll just go to labs. Like they have labs everywhere. It wasn't a thing for me. I always thought I was going to be a mechanic. I love cars. I loved working on cars. I liked building and modifying cars, fixing cars. I love the physical like nature of it. I don't like the laying under a car and being sore and reaching over a car and do like that kind of got old, but I was like, oh, these are really fascinating. I love doing it. This is probably what I'm gonna do forever. And I moved to college and had to pay for my way through college. And so I had three jobs. I had a job in the mailroom. I had a job in the transportation department washing vans because I thought that would get me some sort of in to be able to be a mechanic at some point. And I had a job in what we called student services for technology, babysitting labs. Like literally there was a lab across the hallway from my room.
Yeah.
And there was someone in there all the time. And I was just like, hey, how do I get this job? Because then I can do my homework and I don't have to go somewhere else and I can get paid for doing my homework. And so I signed up for that lab job and I was like, okay, cool. I do this on Saturdays and Sundays. I sit in this lab and I do my homework. During the week, I do my mailroom job Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I'm my transportation job Tuesday, Thursday. And that was my jobs. And I was like my freshman year basically was kind of mixing between those things. And then later on, it was like, you know, the transportation job wasn't really working out. The mailroom job was too early. So I'm like, I'm just going to do this lab job because it's super easy. I don't know anything about computers, but I can just sit here and do my homework. But I started learning things. I started being around people that also knew computers. And then they're like, hey, this campus, this was 2001, 2002. My sophomore year was 2002. And it was a campus that had Wi-Fi. And nobody had Wi-Fi, not even at your house. Like this wasn't a thing. And so they're like, hey, our campus has Wi-Fi, but people come to the school and don't have Wi-Fi cards. Like no one has Wi-Fi in a laptop, even if they had a laptop. We actually had like a laptop rental program because no one had it. So at the beginning of the year, we would take thousands of computers and we would install Wi-Fi cards in them.
Interesting.
And this is like Windows 98, Windows 2000, Windows ME, Mac 7. 7 and 8. And like this, like you don't have USB drives. You don't have any of that stuff. Yeah. So you're like CDs.
Zip drives at that point.
Some of them. Zips. And like that was like this thing is really weird. Like people like need this thing and we had this internet, but like I learned a ton of stuff through doing that through this student services of like, I'm learning technology, but it wasn't like, I didn't feel good at it. I didn't feel like this was going to be my job. It wasn't like something that clicked. I'm going to be all over this thing. It was just kind of like, okay, well, this is a thing. I do it for work and that's fine. I worked in the technology group through my, 4 years at school. I got a job immediately after graduating. I went in the tech department. I was just like, no one else would hire me, but I have this like reputation here. So I worked in the help desk. I answer phone calls, doing help, just helping people like debug things. And I was at the university for like 9 years doing help desk, doing endpoint computing with like laptops, printers, all that sort of stuff. And then doing it as a sysadmin. And I never, that whole time, I literally was taking classes at the junior college on car design, suspension design, port and polishing engines. I was like, I'm still going to be a mechanic. This technology thing is just a fad. Like, I'm not, like, it's just paying my bills right now so I can go to school so I can be a mechanic. And it wasn't until I left the university when I went over to Disney Animation where I actually was like, oh, they doubled my salary.
Yeah. Like, okay. This tech money is good. Yeah.
Like a thing that's like, oh, I could just do this. I don't have to do the mechanic thing anymore. I don't have to do the physical. I worked in construction in college, like summer jobs. I had construction jobs. And so I was like, I just always did physical labor. And I was like, actually, I don't have to do the construction job anymore either. Like, I could just do the technology. And so I didn't feel like I was amazing at it. It didn't feel like I was going to always be this technology. I was like, oh, this one pays really well. And I only need one job. And that's a great thing to only need the one job and doing something in a really cool environments like Disney Animation and working on a really amazing product and all that sort of stuff. Like, I could just like work in a basement and like write some code and then go watch a cartoon once a year. That's really cool. Like, let's just do that for now. And that's kind of like, I guess the settling of like, I'm not going to do something else is when I finally got that job. And I was like, okay, this is going to be my career now in this technology field.
Yeah. I mean, there's a ton I want to kind of drill into a little bit. I think, you know, the interesting thing to me is like, you had no real interest initially, but I think, you know, I think you probably didn't realize at the time, maybe if you kind of think of like backwards, you're like, oh, like I did kind of have a knack for this a little bit, right? Like maybe you learn things a bit faster, or maybe you were a bit more interested in kind of debugging or troubleshooting or whatever. But I want to like drill into like the car thing, because I think one of the things that I've realized over doing this show, I think I just crossed over 100 episodes. Congrats. Yeah, thank you. It's everybody in tech, or that's not fair. Most people in tech have like a hobby that's like not anywhere close to tech. Like some people play music like myself, or some people
woodwork.
They garden, they landscape, you know, in like the car thing, at least to me, you know, yes, there are some hardware pieces to technology, like you can get into the maker space and all of that. But like, I can't think of a lot of jobs that are like different on the spectrum as it pertains to like what your day to day is than being like an auto mechanic and being like a software developer. Right. For a lot of reasons. So I'm curious, one, like, what are some of the things that you think about when you're, you know, obviously I imagine you're probably still interested in cars, like some of the skills or the abilities that translate between the two sort of things, like being a technologist and being somebody who's on the engineering, mechanical, like tactical side. And then obviously, because we're going to talk about cars, like what is the car for you?
I think that one thing for car, like I always want to be a driver, was like the thing I actually wanted to do. It's like, I wanted to be a stunt driver, a race car driver, something like that. Cause I love driving. Sure. And, but in order to get there, I had to work on the cars. I had to understand the cars. Cause like the best drivers know their cars in and out. Like they know every little piece of it and how it interacts and how it makes it better and how it reacts to things. Mm-hmm. And understanding the system, the complex system that you interact with through a simple API, like steering wheel and pedals and a gear shift. That's what you get. Like, that's how you drive the system. And underneath the hood, it is insanely complex. The amount of moving pieces, and not only just like your car, but like engines have different properties, whether it's like a hemispherical head or electric engines or Wankel rotary engines, and all these things act differently and react differently. And I, a lot of times, pull those analogies up of like, people think Kubernetes is hard and like they should go look under their hood of their car. Because I guarantee you, like the amount of the systems that interact in that environment and the amount of things that can go wrong and are going wrong all the time. Like people have like, V6 engine spinning at, let's say, 3000 RPMs or something like that. Like it's misfiring constantly. You just don't know it. And it doesn't bubble that up because it's not important. And the same thing can happen in a technology system where it's like, actually that pod or that service or that call, whatever, it's going to fail over and over again, but we're just going to retry next time. And it's okay because we don't need to bubble that up to a warning light on the dashboard because you actually don't care. And it's like, that's fine. We're just going to fix that one until it's actually a problem. And like figuring out that balance of where's the actual problem versus the, we can just ignore this and keep going, I think is a really interesting way to think about these complex systems. Even down to like a single computer, with a CPU and memory and GPU and how those interact and cache misses and all these things, like that scales all the way down and all the way up. And it's still, you give someone a simple API or a simple interface that is more or less I can understand, like, this is always feels this way, right? Like, cars weren't standardized until like the 1930s, when like steering wheel was put on one side, and they used to drive in the center. They used to have like sticks to steer. They did all these things, but like, okay, no, we know we need a gas pedal. We need a brake pedal. We need a steering wheel. And if you go look at like old Model Ts, they got like four pedals. They have a pedal for reverse. Like, there's a dedicated pedal for like go backwards. And like, if you hit that by accident, like, what are you going to do? Like, there's, you know, like, you have to like learn these things over time. And then that, now that we're in this technology phase of like, things are kind of consistent and we kind of know how this system should act, it's a little easier to adapt to the system. And then when you need to open the hood and take out the engine or something, you can figure out how and why that works. And that's something that I always found interesting. It's just like how people interact with cars, and then how cars interact in a larger system. Living in Southern California, cars are a big part of like environment and freeways and everything else. And just seeing that there are literally thousands or millions of cars that are going places, and they all can interact well with just some traffic lights and a couple signs, is fascinating.
Well, in quotes, right?
well enough to assume that it's functioning the way it's intended to. And those sorts of things. And then we can replace freeways, and we can expand them, or, you know, add pay, you know, toll roads and all this stuff. A lot of that, like, to me, like, I just break down technology in these like physical realms of like things that I understand a little better. Or, like, I drive a car without thinking.
Sure.
Can I also operate Kubernetes without thinking? Maybe. Like, at some point, like, I'll be able to get to that. It's so natural now that I don't really need to think about it. I can just know, oh, that sound that my back tire is making, it means it's low on air. And this, you know, this sound that this load balancer is making, like, that log is kind of repeatable, and I understand how that works. And feeling out those things just becomes really natural.
You never answered the car question. What is the car?
The car question goes, so there's a couple questions for a car question. There's a, the one that I love and is attainable.
Yeah, that's the question, right? Like, I know that you probably have like some like McLaren or like some like Bugatti or some like some car that is unattainable because of a lot of reasons, right? There's five of them in the world. Like, what is the car that is attainable though? Like, a car that you could go and get today, and like, maybe you're not super thrilled about like what you pay monthly on it, but like, you could do it.
Well, no, like, my favorite car since I was in high school was a classic Mini Cooper.
Very good.
It's just, I loved how small they were. I loved how practical they were. They were engineered for a time when gas was expensive and we had to make trade-offs on the design of cars. And those impacted things that were beyond the car. Where the car was this size, and now actually parking spots could be smaller and roads could be a little smaller. You have to design these things really large. I just got back from a trip from Japan, and seeing the car sizes in Japan was fascinating to me, because they literally have their license plates will be different colors for like, if you have an engine that's under 600 CCs or over 600 CCs. And it's like those big engines of 600 CCs. I was like, I got like a 3 liter out in the, out in the driveway.
Yeah,
right now.
That's crazy. Yeah, no, I mean, it like that. So that is interesting solely to the fact, like, the small car thing. Like, I was curious about like why small cars in Europe were such a big deal for a small amount of time, right? Like Mini Cooper, like Peugeots were very small. Like there's like this whole straight like genre of car in Europe that don't really translate well in the US because America, like, you know, that are very small. And I was thinking about it, and somebody was, you know, listed out some of the reasons to me, and I was like, also like, more cars fit in a city if they're smaller. Like, if you're driving on London, right? Like, you only have X amount of space in the city of London, right, for a car. And, you know, yes, public transportation is good, but a lot of people get around by car, by taxi or whatever, right? So it is, that is great. I think, so well, my car, if you're curious. Oh, good. Yeah. You're going to say something.
I was just saying, like, a lot of that is unintentional too.
Yeah.
A lot of the small cars, small CCs came out of what was available at the time, right? Because a lot of cars were built during World War II.
Yep.
And a lot of cars were designed during that time. No, there's no steel. There's no gas. There's no, all of these things were cars. And like in Japan, right? Like there was, they were occupied by the United States for a very long time. And they had restrictions on how big of an engine they could make, because they didn't want them making planes. They didn't want them doing it. Like, and then so they built to the restriction. And they said, okay, what can we do? Because we still need something. Yep. But if you look at some of the like classic Japanese cars from like the late 40s and 50s, like they're like three-seaters, and they have like little motorcycle engines and like motorcycle handles, and those sorts of things are in them because they had restrictions placed on them artificially But in places like the United States and Europe and stuff like they were just like, we just don't have the resources. So we just got to build something and get it out there, because people do need something still. So like the Volkswagen Bug and Mini Coopers and those sorts of things came out as like, hey, this is how we are. This is what we got. This is what we could build you. But it also helped design the cities around them. And those constraints on one area ended up impacting more people's lives on how far they could travel, because they couldn't carry as much gas, and how much they could carry home because they needed smaller appliances because they just had no truck. Right? Like, this is a thing that happens. But what's your car?
So mine's cliche. So like I grew up, I think you and I are of similar ages. So like when I was in high school, a movie called Gone in 60 Seconds came out.
Eleanor.
Yeah, so like that car, for whatever reason, like I just the style, the lines of it, like I see that, like I see them every now and then out in the real world, like a late 60s Shelby Mustang, and I'm like, yeah, that's the car. I don't know if that's obtainable, because I would be terrified to drive it for a lot of reasons. But yeah, like that's the car. Like, you know, I think it's funny, like the car that I end up all like. So my wife and I drive Subarus, like we just always driven Subarus. So like I'll look at, like now I have like an Affinity, and it like I'll look at a non Subaru, and it, because it doesn't look like a Subaru, I'm like, I don't really like the way that car looks. And my wife was like, that's just because it doesn't look like a Subaru. I'm like, yeah, that's probably fair.
I'm on my fourth Subaru.
yeah. No, like I have a 2016 Impreza that my kids won't drive in because it's too loud. And I'm like, and my wife says, just get a new one. And I'm like, why? So I can just get the new version of this car. Like, I don't need the new version of this car. Subarus are great. But like, when you're only buying a certain like brand, you're very limited to what your options are. And occasionally I'm like, oh, maybe I do want to drive something else. But nah.
My first four or five cars all cost me $1,000. Because that was how much money I had cash. And I was just like, I have to buy it. So I learned to work on cars because of that, because I was like, I have to buy the cheap car. I'm going to have to be the mechanic for it. And that's like, I had to get the lower price thing. And like, same with my first computers. My first computers were like enterprise, you know, auction machines, because I was like, I could never buy a new computer. So it was just like friends, old parts and whatever. I'd piece them together. And the same way I would work on cars, I would just maintain a computer in this, like, I'm running, like the reason I got into Linux in college was because I couldn't afford a Windows license. I had an old desktop from an enterprise that was at the time was already, you know, 5-6 years old. And I'm like, I don't know what this is going to run, but I learned about this Linux thing. Let me try it. And it was free, and I could just install it and run it. And I've been using Linux on a desktop ever since.
I feel like if you were born 60 years early, you would have been that CEO that started in the mailroom. Like, you definitely would have been that guy. Like, I think, you know, just from this short amount of time I've been talking to, and then like the backstory of kind of knowing like your online presence, like you have like this hustle mentality that doesn't, it almost is like from a bygone era. Like, people hustle now, but I think that people expect immediate results from the hustle. I think you, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is diving into kind of your psychic makeup or psycho makeup. Like you're okay with a little bit of waiting. You're like, you are very long-term oriented, right? Like, is that fair to say about you? Like, you see the big picture and things a bit quicker?
I don't think I see the, I don't expect things.
Yeah,
that's kind of the difference. Maybe it's not necessarily like I know where this is going, but I was just like, I don't really expect anything from this. This is just the right thing to do right now. And that's okay. Yeah. And it's okay to be able to do the right thing right now. And maybe you do 10 of those right things and they end up pointing you in a direction. And that's fine too. And being able to say, like, I don't need to see 10 years down the road. I just need to see tomorrow. And if I do the right thing today for tomorrow and tomorrow for the next day and the next day, okay, then I can start to adjust for where does this month bring me? And where does this 6 months bring me? And that sort of reflectiveness, because for a long time I've had a calendar appointment to reflect every quarter. I have an afternoon that's blocked on my calendar that I fill up my brag doc of just like things that I thought went well in the last quarter. And then just like kind of adjust things of like, hey, this thing isn't working. I'm going to give it up. And that's okay to say, like, I thought this might have results, or I thought this might lead me in a certain direction, and maybe it's not. And it's okay to just say, like, at this quarter, I drop it because I have something new to do on instead of, you know, what I thought was going to be the thing I needed to work on now.
Yeah. I mean, one, I think that's a great, especially in tech, like whenever people ask me like, oh, like, what do you see like 18 months, 3 years? I'm like, no idea. Like,
doesn't matter.
2 years ago, ChatGPT, people, there's probably people aware of it, but like not mass hysteria, right? So like the technology can flip on its side almost immediately. I do think you use the idea of like, you know, just kind of focusing on the right now, or maybe like the really, really short term. And then like the long term is going to figure itself out. And like, I like the way you kind of, you mentioned specifically, like you're okay with waiting. And like, the reason why I bring this up is because I think you and I are of a similar age, right? So like older millennials, or maybe like a little bit outside the millennial bracket, right? Millennials have like this very bad stereotype. It's like, we're very impatient. We want results now. And I think a lot of it is because we grew up in a world where it's like the entire opening of information like was just gifted to us, right? Like, what do you think like gives you the patience? Like, is it upbringing? Is it, you know, maybe the fact that you grew up like, you know, not interested, like you were interested in things, but like you weren't immediately like, oh, I have this and I have this and I have this and there's no expectations. Like, what do you think kind of is the source of your like patience when it comes to these things?
I mean, I guess one thing that if I look back kind of reflects that is the fact that I was really late to technology, like sure. In life. I guess yeah. It's like, I got my job at Disney in 2014. And so I was mm-hmm. like, I'm only 10 years in to this, like technology is my career sort of
sure,
thing.
Sure.
I had a computer before that, but like when I was a kid, like I played sports. I went outside and I threw rocks. I dug holes. Like when you're like, when I was a kid, like the thing to do was just like go outside with a shovel and just dig a hole and see how big of a hole you can dig. And that's what I would do like on the weekends. And I was just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just digging a hole. What is this going to lead to? Doesn't matter. It was just fun. It was just the thing that I wanted to do at the time. And so like, when I look back at that and I think like people have been doing this for their life, they're like, I was 5 years old. I got my first computer and I built an app. And I'm like, that's crazy. Like, I can't imagine having access to that amount of information and being overwhelmed by that much stuff at that age. And now I'm just like, I take a much more casual approach to this because I'm like, I'm so late to this. It doesn't really matter. Like, I'm not going to be the best performer. I'm not trying to be the best. I'm not trying to be the person who's like the 10X engineer. I'm like, that's okay. Like, I let someone else that's been doing it for a lot longer than me be the best at some of those things. I'm just trying to be like the best version of me with my background and with my upbringing and working in construction and understanding some cars. And now like I do this technology thing, those all vary a lot of ways. And people sometimes just don't have the varied background.
Yeah.
Where there's like, I've been on a computer since I was five. I don't know what it's like to go outside.
Sure.
I'm like, well, let's talk about it. Let me go rent a cool car and we're going to go drive in it. And you will feel like exhilaration and be scared and things that like you maybe have never felt before, except for on a roller coaster, which is still like a very protected environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let's just like, I used to go to racetracks and racetracks are they're super fun and they're scary and that's okay. And it's like, I could wreck my car if I take this turn wrong. And then I literally have no money to buy a new car because I wasn't making tech money. Right?
Like sure.
All of these things are problems. And not only could I get hurt, but like all this stuff could be a problem. And like those sorts of things, like I just try to take that broader picture of just like, I'm so late to this that I'm 40 now. If I get into something brand new at 45, that's fine.
Yeah.
Like I could go into like, it doesn't actually matter. Like I'm doing the right thing for today and tomorrow. And then we'll see what 6 months looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably the reason why technology is stuck with you is because every couple of years, like something weird shows up and you kind of have to learn it or you stay in the same job forever and whatever, that's fine. But I think that, and I'm not to say that you have ADHD or whatever, but it's like this, like always wanting to like try out something shiny and new is very like something that I see a lot with people that are in tech like us that are like, always trying to like vocal on social media, trying to learn new things, playing around with stuff, right? Like I think those sort of folks, they tend to just be curious by nature, right? And like the idea of like stagnating or staying in the same tech or the same place for a long time isn't super interesting. I imagine this is probably a silly question based on the conversation, but like, do you remember a time when you weren't like very curious about how things work? Or has it always been there?
Nah, even when I was a kid, like tools were fascinating to me. I do remember taking apart a VCR when I was a kid.
Everybody did that. Like our age, everybody did that. Like I've said this story a million times. Like I took apart the first computer that my family got like day two. And my dad is like, fix this now. Right. Cause like we had it was on layaway for like 6 months and then we got it. Yeah. And yeah, I just remember like this moment of panic because I'm like, I don't know how to put this back together, but I figured it out. And it beeped, which was the only thing that really mattered, right?
Yeah, I had a post. We're good.
Yeah, yeah. I interrupted you. Like, do you like tools were interesting? What else?
No, like I mean, like I always do like to learn things because I just find how things work fascinating, like the show how stuff works and finding out like is all of those sorts of things are just like, wow, like there's a lot behind this. When I look at like my AirPods right here, like this is a simple little thing, right? It's just a little case with headphones in it. And then like, you take one of these apart and then take apart the battery. And then, and not only do you realize that like, it's technically hard, like I could not build this, but also then you think of like all of the people and process that went into this design, this testing, the automation, the manufacturing, shipping, like this is a lot of stuff that had to happen for this. Cause there's stores, there's all this stuff that like, are interacting with this AirPods, you know, and like how does that interact with like the bigger picture again? It's like, how do cars travel on the freeway? Because like, because 60, 70 years ago, like FDR was like, we need a highway system longer than that now, right? But like, that's like, we had this highway system, like that history impacted what we have today and what we're capable of today. Yeah. And I love seeing, I didn't grow up with technology. And so I feel like I missed out on a lot of things because of that. So I read a lot of historical books of just like tech history, like company history and like culture history. I love reading how things got where they're at because that stuff fascinates me on just like this decision that someone made a long, long time ago is impacting a lot of stuff we can or cannot do today. And then what are the decisions I make today that in 60 to 80 to 100 years might impact someone on what they can do? And open source is a big part of that. Because open source is this like really, like we haven't talked about open source at all.
No.
But like that's a big part of like what is capable in the future. Because when I started computers, like the only open source I knew of was Linux. And I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't know open source. Like I just knew it meant free, like as in I can download it. And free as in I didn't have to pay a license for it.
Yeah.
Was because it was open source. I didn't contribute back. It was just like, oh, this is a CD. Like Ubuntu mailed me CDs. That's cool. Like I can just hand these out to friends and it's completely free operating system. And that was my interaction with introduction to open source. And that sort of stuff impacted me to be able to like, wow, the open source we write today is going to impact someone else that's in college in 10 years because they get this free thing. And what do they get to learn because we open source something today?
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad to hear that like you're thinking of is, and this was something that I was going to ask you. It's like, how much do you care about like the history of tech? Or when you talk to people that have been in tech for 30 years and they're telling you all these horror stories of whatever, right? Like, do you have empathy or you're just like, okay, boomer, right? I was curious as to that, but it seems to me like you're like, you want not to feel the pain of what it was like, but just to have an understanding of how we got to this point. Look, I'm still like, when we go to the bank, and like, you know, you put your deposit in like the pneumatic tube. Like my wife laughs at me because I just like, I geek out on that. And that's like that's like just a vacuum and just nonsense, right? But I'm just like, this is the greatest like example of modern innovation ever. Like nobody needed this. Like nobody needed the ability to get this letter from here to here quickly, but they did it because they knew it was gonna be faster. But yeah, like the idea of, and this is something that, you know, as we kind of go into open source, like the topic of open source, since you brought it up in the show, is about open source and technology, right? Is that you mentioned you didn't know that like this, you know, free software, you know, Linux sort of environment sort of stuff was open source. When did you really realize like the weight of open source and like the idea that multi-billion-dollar companies, multi-trillion-dollar companies could be completely built on like the idea of software that was built with the free movement, right? I guess like, that's the shortest way to kind of phrase that.
The first time that I understood like anyone could contribute was probably 2007, 2008 timeframe. And I was still using Linux. I was part of the Linux Mint community. I actually, my first podcast was around that time. I ran the Mintcast podcast. Terrible, terrible audio quality. And it was back in the day. It was like, I don't know what we're doing, but we're just trying this thing.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, I can actually contribute back, not only in open source by running a podcast, but I didn't have to write code to contribute to the community. Was a big thing because, again, I wasn't a programmer. I dropped out of my CS minor in college. I did not understand how to program anything. I was like, this is not for me. I'm not doing this technology thing, but I can give back to a community by doing something that wasn't writing code. Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing for me because I was like, oh, I can still contribute. And that was really cool to be able to feel like I had a way to contribute without understanding the code. My first pull request was around the same time, and it was for Ubuntu. And it was for SSH copy ID, like the script that like copies sure. your SSH key to a host or whatever authorized keys. And I was like, oh, it duplicates it. Let me just remove that duplication. And so I like added like a little sed to like remove it or whatever. And I contributed back. This took me like a day to figure out like how this sure, thing sure. works, where to contribute it and like all this stuff. And it was rejected. They didn't take my pull request. They're like, actually, we don't care. Like just if someone does it, they'll duplicate keys. It doesn't matter. And I was like, it doesn't matter. It's just, we're like, this is a lot of like, it's not something we're going to maintain. We don't care. And I felt devastated by that. It was yeah. just like, oh, like the code contribution that I gave was rejected and mm-hmm. someone didn't care about the thing I cared about
sure.
because I wanted it to be slim and I wanted to like, and, yeah. and looking back, yeah, it doesn't care. And I would probably reject that same pull request today if it came to one of my projects, but like it was, I was heartbroken and I was just like, yeah. I don't think I fit in this code portion of open source. I fit sure. in the community side of open yeah. source. I fit in the podcast or the content side of it to help other people get into the community, but hopefully one of them's a programmer because it's not me. And that's when I kept like, oh, I don't understand why this open source thing is source. Like, why do we call it source? Because it's yeah. more than source. Like there's mm-hmm. a lot more that goes into it than just the source code. And to your other question of like, when did I realize that like big things were built on this was again, probably when I went to Disney. And I didn't realize the scope of at Disney Animation, like it was a Linux shop, like everything ran Linux. And I was on the Linux engineering team and they brought me in to build like a Linux distro internally for them that made the movies. And I was like, when I look at the credits of a movie, I was like, there's a lot of people involved. There's all the artists, there's all these things. And then when I finally worked in the system, I was like, all those artists are basically writing software.
Sure.
They draw bits on a screen that get rendered into this image that gets shipped to you on a disk. It is box software. You have a Blu-ray drive that has a Java interpreter on it. Java runs your menus and then spits out the yeah. stream of bits. It is box software. And I was like, oh my gosh, like everything I've been doing is enabling other developers
yeah.
to not even think about some of this underlying technology and hide it underneath them. And all of the cool things that were built on open source, where it was a, you know, Linux distros, it was actually the first place I worked that had no Windows. Like there was no, the Active Directory was like a slave or a mirroring from LDAP, not the other yeah. way around. Like everywhere else I worked before, it was like, oh, we have this LDAP thing over here, but it's mainly off of Active Directory, and Active Directory is the source. And then we just mirror. I was like, no, it's the other way. I was like, no, LDAP was the source. Everything went to LDAP, and like, oh, we had to have Active Directory because we had a handful of Windows machines for the sure. lawyers or yeah. marketing or something like that. And that was the first time I was like, everything here is open source. Like, except for the tools that we were writing, like a yeah. lot of the tools we were writing, like we just kept those tools because they got thrown away every
very
movie.
Proprietary like, too, right? Like solving a very specific need for this at Disney, right? Not
right.
Not, yeah. Cause there's open source that people use and there's open source that like people don't use. Like you could have open sourced it, but it's like, what value does it bring to the community? Right? Like that's another thing too, that I find pretty interesting about open source is that, you know, you talk to people like, oh, I just, you know, I create a repo and I throw out my stuff out there and if people want to use it, cool. I'm like, are you ever going to go back to it? Probably not. No. So why do you have just like, that's my thing too. Like if people go to my, like, I don't like having lots of repos because I think of it as just kind of junk. So like, I'll go out, like every now and then I'll go out and I'll just delete a bunch of stuff that I haven't touched in a couple of years because I don't know, like I have some OCD thing. I don't know what it is, but that's an interesting question I'd like to ask you is it's like, when does open source have value, or creating software and making it open source have value? And when is it not bring value or have value?
I mean, not all code has value.
Sure, sure.
Value is a very subjective term in general. Yeah. Like how you say something has value or not. A lot of the things, like the value that I have from a lot of my projects is the fact that I learned something while creating it.
Yep.
And someone else will not get the same learning because they didn't create it. They didn't struggle with the thing for, you know, a night and say like, how does this thing actually work? I don't know. I have to figure out this line of code. And while I was at Disney, I wrote a tool that we had Puppet as our configuration management system. And we were doing it with client-side rendering for the Puppet manifest to manage all the systems. And I wrote this wrapper around Puppet that would allow it to run Puppet locally and send some stats to a InfluxDB, a time series database. Because we had no way, like we had a Puppet database, like all this stuff, like we couldn't collect it and see it visually. We couldn't graph it out and say like, how long do our Puppet runs take? Which ones are failing? All this stuff. So I wrote a little tool for it. It was a little Python, you know, maybe a couple hundred lines of Python. It didn't actually take that long to do. Refined it a couple of times. I'm like, hey, I want to open source this. I think this has value because every time I go talk to someone else at other environments, if they have Puppet, they actually are doing something similar. And at that point, I was like, okay, once I found that we had alignment on things, I could add value to them by open sourcing this thing and allowing it to be a starting point for where they could start or they can contribute back. It didn't even matter if they contributed back because it was like, this could just be an open source thing. So I wrote the thing. I went through, there was like multiple layers of approval process inside of a place like Disney for like my manager had to approve it. Our lawyers had to approve it. The Disney corporate lawyers had to approve it. There was, I had to talk to like people for like, is this patentable software? Yeah. I'm like, no, it's like, it's literally like, it's like 200 lines of Python that just wraps another command. Like it's just doesn't do anything fancy. Yeah. Like we run the command, we get the output, we stick it in an Influx database. It's like, that's it. And so, but it took months to finally like, okay, like we, 4 or 5 months later, and my CTO approved it. He's like, this is great. We're actually open sourcing some stuff. Yeah. We're going to add value back to the community. Mm. And that was like I'm going to actually like, oh, I'm going to have code contributions that are going to add value to someone else. And that was really cool because I was like, this is something that I created, not contributed to, not went and like fixed some docs. Not so like I created this from scratch. Like it was like one of the very first times that I had a blank IDE and I made something and we were going to ship it. And literally it was like 2 days before we were going to like open source the repo and everything. My director came and said, we're not open sourcing that. I said, why? Like I got all the approvals. This has been going on for months. Why are we not going to go through with all this work that we've been doing? We're still using the tool in production, literally on the Disney Animation website. There's still a screenshot from my tool. I don't think they don't use it anymore. Hopefully they don't use it anymore, but there's still a screenshot because it was a cool visualization. And I'm like, why can't we open source this? He said, because it doesn't add value to us. It doesn't bring Disney the type of attention that we want. It doesn't bring Disney Animation, that it doesn't give us notoriety in the areas we want notoriety. So the things we were open sourcing were things around animation and things around rendering and things around these other things that were in the areas where we wanted to have, you know, notoriety and be able to hire people based on those things. We didn't want to hire people that write terrible Python scripts that my puppet.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah.
And those are like that, like realization was like, okay, number one, I probably don't fit here was my first realization I may not fit in this environment if we only want to open source the things that bring us value. And the second thing was I need to switch teams. I need to find something else to do because I felt crushed that I did all of this work. I got all of this approval. And then at some point, like I, at the very minimum, I need to work on something else because if I start touching this anymore, I'm going to be devastated that like, I don't want to do this anymore. And that was like the, one of the, you know, open source corporate open source stories for myself. That's just like, okay, what does it actually mean to be an open source contributor and work inside of a big corporate environment and still try to work on open source or do things in a community?
Yeah, that's wild. I mean, not surprising at all, because that's just how the world is. I'm curious to know, like, you know, how do you not get disheartened a little bit? Where it's like, you know, like it, especially initially, because they're like, people were excited. And then there was this realization. It's like, but what's it really in it for us? And I think that like, you know, if you think about the developer community and the open source community, it's like, that's like the antithesis of what the community stands for. It's like, what's in it for us, right? But you know, everybody has their reasons. So I'd imagine at this point in time, there was probably a thought, like you mentioned, like, oh, do I fit in here? Obviously, you found other things to focus on that you could, that brought you joy. Like, so my when did you, and the reason why I want to think this kind of transition is you've started to do more and more things, I'd imagine, like, in, I don't know if it was leading teams or just thinking about new ideas, but like thinking about, and I don't know what time this is. I imagine this is probably close to when you start looking into Kubernetes and things like that. Like, when did you realize, like, maybe I should start thinking about different ways to solve problems?
I definitely started realizing the political impacts inside of a company, but also in open source, because it's all people.
Yep.
And figuring out that open source is just people at different companies made me also realize, as I started getting into Kubernetes, there were, you know, political and decisions being made that weren't because they were the best technology, mm-hmm. but because they allowed someone to get value from a system. And if you go watch like the Kubernetes documentary, which is up on YouTube, I forget the creator, it's fantastic. But the documentary goes into, like, they talk about why we created Kubernetes. And it was like, we needed leverage in cloud.
Yeah.
Like, we needed to create something to pull away power from Amazon. And Amazon was the big place, and Amazon had all of the services, and Google over here trying to do App Engine and all these other things, they had a big container focus, and like, how can we make this container thing better? And Kubernetes wasn't their first Kubernetes open source, or Kubernetes wasn't the first container orchestrator from Google.
Sure.
Like, people often forget that, like, let me container that for you.
Yeah.
It was like their first open source thing. And like, it wasn't, but it was a technology decision, not a political decision. And Kubernetes came along. It's like, hey, they knew early on, we needed buy-in from someone else. And we need to have someone else partner with us, because if this is just a Google thing, it's always going to be just a Google thing. And so they partnered with Red Hat. And they said, Red Hat, we need you to come on board and do this thing with us. And they started partnering with other companies. They say, hey, we need you to do these pieces with us. So this is more than just a Google project. And, and the politics of open source played out much bigger. And that's why the CNCF exists, right? Like, CNCF exists to be this neutral home, to be able to let all these competing companies come play politics in a neutral area. Essentially, like, they own the, CNCF owns all of the licensing, and they own a lot of the, like, how the project, not how the project runs, but they can own a lot of those, like, political decisions around open source and how those things get built out and tied together. And that's why some of that, look, Linux Foundation exists as well. Like, right. Like, there's a bunch of competing Linux distros, and they all would argue nonstop if they don't have some place to say, like, actually the kernel has to be open.
We're all friends here, right? Like, a place where it's like, we're all friends here. Like, everybody leave your baggage at the door. Friends here. I remember talking to, like, I've had Joe Beat on the show, who, Joe Beat is one of the founders of Kubernetes, right? And like, the things that he talked about, I remember in that episode, is like the amount of just like, are we trying to solve a problem, or are we trying to invent a problem to have something to solve that problem? And that's kind of one of the things that I'd like to talk with you about, is like the idea of, you know, Kubernetes in general. Like, I think that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it became like the thing that everybody has to learn, regardless of what your role is in tech, right? And I'd like to get your thoughts, is like, what was Kubernetes like? How did it introduce, like, what was your first experience with Kubernetes, like, introductory? Like, did you realize how valuable it was going to be? Do you see it as a lot of noise? Like, I'm genuinely curious, as somebody who I think is, you know, somebody who is well versed in it. Like, I'd like to know your initial thoughts.
I was looking at containers as like a way of packaging, and there's a lot of things that look like containers, even inside of Disney Animation. I was at Disney at the time, and Disney Animation, like, we ran things in C groups before Docker. Like, we just, like, oh, our render jobs, we just, like, we need to constrain it by process. So it was like, C groups existed, and we just started running it. And we didn't really have, like, we didn't need user splitting or separate networking or host names or all that stuff. But, like, these container things started coming out. And so, like, oh, this is a fascinating, like, way of packaging something that isn't just a runtime thing. Like, I can actually package it and share it with someone. And we had a Jira ticket that was allow the web team to self-deploy their applications. Because the process at the time was, they send an email, they get a VM, they SSH to that VM, they set up some sort of Jenkins SSH Git pull sort of thing. And that was how they have to do like 2 days of work to like go deploy an app, right? And that's not including the like day or two for like the VMware admin to like give them a VM, say, here's your IP address, all that stuff.
It's like it's like the most sophisticated copy to a server ever, right? Like,
yeah, and that's just how we did it.
yeah.
that was just the standard way. And so there was this Jira ticket that existed from, I remember it was like that when I started, it was there, and like 2 years later, it was still there. And I was like, okay, these containers are kind of working. And I started setting up container hosts that I would run, and they would just send me a container and I would pull it down. And I was like, oh, cool. I don't need to like worry about your code and all that stuff. And you don't need to worry this. I had a load balancer to it. And I was like, this is really fascinating. But I really like Mesos, and I liked how Mesos like worked, and I like its pluggable architecture for schedulers and all that other stuff. And I was like, oh, Mesos could be like the underlying system, and we could have our scheduler for our render jobs, and we could have scheduler for web services. We have scheduler for all this stuff because we built our own scheduler for rendering the art, right? But Mesos could like, what if we containerized it and all this stuff? So I was going down that route and starting to deploy it, and Kubernetes came out, and I'm like, it didn't sound pluggable at all. Yeah. Like it was just like, here's a binary that runs your API, and here's an etcd distributed database. Like, I don't need a distributed database. I was like, I have a hardware box that has redundant power supplies and redundant network and redundant ACs and redundant hard drives. I don't need three hosts to run a database. I have one. And so I was like, I don't need all that complexity from Kubernetes. And it also, I didn't see how it would even work with a scheduler that you could plug in all this other stuff. And so a lot of people that got into Kubernetes have a Kelsey story. And Kelsey Hightower was in LA. And I remember he was like going back to the airport. He tweeted like, hey, I got a couple hours to kill in LA. Anyone around? I'm like, why don't you drive up to Burbank? I was like, I'll show you the Disney offices. And so I did. Like, he came up. I showed him around a little bit. And we just started chatting for a couple hours. And I told him, I was like, the reason I don't like Kubernetes is because it's not pluggable. The system's not pluggable. And he's like, actually, it is. He's like, go look at the API. Go understand how the API works, and you can actually figure out where you can fit things in. And at the time, it wasn't called CRDs. It was I forget what the old name was called. Sure. But this initial kind of idea around like custom resources were coming out, but it wasn't there yet. And so I was like, okay, well, let me go look at the API. And I built a scheduler in Bash. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to poke at this with curl. And if I can understand it with curl, then I can understand how to extend it to make it work in a different way. And so that is an open source project. You can go read it. I think it adds value to some people because it's about 100 lines of Bash, and you could actually see what calls you have to make to schedule a pod to a node. And it took me maybe, you know, 2 or 3 lunch breaks. I used to spend my lunchtime spinning up GKE clusters and poking at the API for a little bit and then spinning it down. And over a month of doing that, it cost me like $2.
Yeah.
And I got like the best, you know, classes of like how Kubernetes works, of just like, I just spin it up and poke at it for a little while. And then I was like, okay, I understand how Kubernetes works. I understand how the API works. I understand how it's pluggable. Again, CRDs weren't there. We weren't fully, everything's a controller world yet. But I was like, I understand how the API is made to make this repeatable. And that's when I started taking that Jira ticket of allow the web team to self-deploy. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to try this Kubernetes thing. And I spin up a hardware Kubernetes cluster. It was like the first cluster I ever made. It took me like, I don't know, a month to get it to the provision to like actually deploy, and then like another 2 months to integrate it into the rest of our provisioning systems for on-prem DNS and like host inventory systems and load balancers and all that stuff. Like all the other integrations were more difficult than the like, let's just spin up this node and make it work. And at the end, I was like, I have a Kubernetes cluster that people can deploy applications to. As long as they containerize them, they stick them in our registry, and then they can make this little YAML file that deploys it. And it was way easier for them than the email to VMware to SSH to all that other stuff. Because then at that point too, we had a lot of systems that on the Linux team, we had to help people maintain them. And a year later goes by and they're like, hey, you have to upgrade your RHEL 5 box. And they're like, I don't have time to. Like, that's not, I don't even maintain that anymore. It's like, okay, how do we just eliminate that from them? And containerization was definitely that initial proposition for that, but it wasn't all the pieces. Because even with my 3 or 4 Docker hosts, I was like, I literally had a spreadsheet that's like this Docker containers on this host with this port, and it's this team, here's the repo. And I had a spreadsheet for it. And that's how we would load balance. And I'm like, wait, one of my first KubeCon talks was literally like, how is Kubernetes like a spreadsheet? And like, we've rebuilt Kubernetes, all the working pieces of Kubernetes with a spreadsheet. And I'm like, oh, I can act this out. I can show people that etcd is literally just a spreadsheet. And that's how I ran the Docker containers. And that's how I can understand how etcd works. And so piecing those things together was like, okay, now I can help other people understand how this thing works and why it might add value to them. If it doesn't, that's fine too. You don't need it. If you have redundant power supplies, like, you don't need 5 etcd nodes necessarily. Like, figure out what your constraints are and build for that.
I think it's pretty fascinating. Like, going back to something that you mentioned a bit earlier, like your first attempt at open source that didn't really work out the way you wanted to. It's like you build something trying to solve a Justin problem. And then you realize like, oh, like maybe this isn't just a Justin problem. Like, and I think that's what the beauty of open source is that you build something, and if you think it's a good idea for other people to see it, like you just throw it out there. Obviously, there's caveats to that. I'd like to get your thoughts too, as somebody who probably is paying attention to tech, and like, how often do you just go out there and look at new stuff?
All the time. I mean, that's just like a constant. Like, I have found a way, or at least a habit for me to start, like, how do I learn new things and how do I make that fit in without burning out? Cause it's too much information. So you have to figure out like which pieces you're going to pay attention to, but then also how do you consume those things? Cause there's too many people have just like pocket and read later cues that are hundreds of articles long. And you're like, I'm never going to get through this. And at that point, you're never going to start. And so I got into a habit years and years ago of like Sunday nights are my night just to like scan through the things that I learned that week. And I just like, hey, what are the cool things that I found? I bookmarked these articles. If I don't need to read it right then, I'm going to do it Sunday night. And that's cool because Sunday nights are my nights just to learn those things. I started a newsletter a couple years ago and it was basically my way to like take all the things that I learned that week and then like trim it down and then send it to other people. And I was like, hey, maybe this adds value to you because here's 50 things that I learned. It was 1, 2, 3 dev. And I was like, you get one GIF just to, because I love GIFs, two quotes or things that I thought were cool, two thoughts of the week and 3 links. And if I can boil everything that I was doing or learning into 1, 2, and 3, let's go ahead and just share that. Yeah. And I did it for like 100 newsletter posts. And again, it led me down the path that I wanted to go into. And then I was done with it. I made it to 100. I'm like, I don't have to continue this forever. And that's okay. I met people that actually like weird that I'm like, I had subscribers. I didn't even know. And like, it was only like, you know, a few hundred people or something like that. But like people saw me at conferences, like they didn't know me from anything else except for my 1, 2, 3 dev newsletter. And I'm like, that's weird to me because I thought I did other things. They're like, no, I read your newsletter. I'm like, oh, that's great. I'm like, I'm sorry. I'm not going to do it anymore. Like I just, it's at a point where I'm like, I got the value that I needed out of it. It put me in the right direction. And I want to do other things with that time now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you, like, it is very hard for me to be at a conference, like, in Europe, and somebody walks up and says, oh, I love your podcast, and I'm like, people don't listen to my podcast. Like, let's be real. I know that people listen because I can look at the numbers, but, like, nobody actually listens to it. But it's that idea, and this is kind of where I want to end the conversation, because I think it's pertinent to, like, what you're doing these days. Like, this idea of, like, creating content and, like, engaging with the community in an educational way. When did you realize, we were talking about this a bit before we got started, so let me just give a little bit of context. So in my opinion, Justin is one of the best people at taking concepts and making them more accessible with great metaphors and great analogies and maybe some great physical props or whatever, right? When did you find that education part of technology and the community and all of that? Like, when did you find that is something that you're actually enjoyed doing?
I think it was partially when I was a full-time developer and I realized that I didn't like writing code 40 hours a week.
Sure.
I didn't actually like sitting down, like taking a Jira ticket and for 2 weeks of a sprint, fixing it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can do it and I've done it. But at the end of the day, I'm like, I just didn't feel satisfied. And I didn't feel like I actually added value or gave back. And going back to like my early days, you know, doing podcasts, I was like, that's actually when I felt more, because my very first conference talk, I was at Southern California Linux Expo, the very first time I went, and they're like, hey, does anyone have a lightning talk they want to give? Anything you're doing? And I just got up on stage. I'm like, hey, I do a podcast and we do it for Linux Mint. We use all Linux in the editing stack. It's all open source software. We talk about it sometimes. If you are interested in this stuff, just, you know, here's mintcast.com. And I got off the stage and literally this is like the very first conference I ever talked. Someone's like, I listened to your podcast. I'm like, no, you don't. Like, get out. Like, no one listens. Like, this is a terrible, like, I'm sorry. Like, this is, we are really bad at this stuff. And they're like, no, like, I love the news section. I love the interviews. I was like, this is fascinating that that cycle can happen. Yeah. Where I was like, I'm giving back in this way. And then I realized that the thing that I actually like doing more than writing the code to use was to helping someone understand how the code functioned inside of a larger system or how it could impact them. Because again, for me, coming from construction and being a mechanic and doing all these things that I thought was like my worldview of what was possible. When I learned technology, my first job, when I actually was writing code to automate an Excel document, right? Like this, I was part of the help desk. I did cell phone billing and the person before me, like, this bill takes me 3 weeks a year. and I would have 1 week to catch up on things, and then I do it for 3 weeks again. And I'm like, that is a bad job, but I need a job, and we're going to do it. And I was like, there has to be a better way. And so I found out how to write VB script to automate Excel, to take in the CSV file and automate everything that they were doing from 3 weeks to 3 hours. And it took me a few months of just copy and paste code and trial and error. And like, how does this thing work? And then I was like, I can automate that thing. And I wrote code, and then I could become like an actual programmer. Like my first IDE was Excel. And I'm like, actually, the way that I understood that and the way I discovered it, and a lot of people helped me through it. Like this wasn't Justin was amazing at programming and it clicked. I'm like, no, I spent a lot of time in IRC chat rooms and on not even Stack Overflow at the time. There was a Experts Exchange, old website. Everyone hated it, but like it had questions and answers. But then I feel like I can give back in those ways and help other people change their lives, because the amount of things that technology has afforded me in my life of being able to work from home and being able to be paid, you know, double my salary in the help desk and being able to like help my family and my friends and my neighbors. The first time I got a job at Disney and we saw what the offer was, it was like $115,000. I was like, this is amazing. This is more money than I would make. And my wife and I both said, imagine the amount of money we can give away. Yeah. And we both were like, this impacts more than us. This isn't our necessarily, this isn't us. Like we can donate this. And I've been thankful that I've been able to donate tens of thousands of dollars to charities every year, ever since I've been in that position of being able to do that. And when I used to work at nonprofits, I'm like, how do people have hundreds of thousands of dollars they're given to me? Like this is, they're just throwing money at me for free. And now I'm like, I'm in a point, I'm like, I'm not hundreds of thousands of dollars, but I'm giving money to those charities that I think are doing good things in the world that impact much beyond my technology boundaries of like, I can write code and do a thing. And just to like the file, like giving back to a community, like I can impact at conferences and videos and make that accessible to more and more people. When we were building, or we were making Moana, my favorite movie that we worked on. And I, after the movie came out, I was at Disneyland and I saw a little girl with a Moana dress. Mm. And I said, that's the inspiration that I want to have for people in technology. Cause she wants to be that in ways that isn't, I want to be actually Moana, but I want to be like Moana. And I want Moana, the things that Moana was able to do changed my life and allowed me to do new things and, you know, like explore new worlds, all that stuff. And that's the stuff that like, I think a lot of people getting into tech and getting into open source and understanding like this system is too complex and there's too many politics and there's too much to learn. Okay, where can we start?
Yep.
How can we show you one thing that will give you that entry point of like, oh, I understood that. I understood how that thing works. So maybe I can understand this other thing too. And just give them that little glimpse of like, they are smart enough and they belong and they can be here and they can contribute back. Impacting people is much more the long-term goal that I've had for my life for quite a while now, because all of the code that I've written in the past disappears. And I hope that it's not being run in production anymore.
Yeah.
And I found that a lot of the docs that I write still exist places. Old companies that I've worked for, like they've come up to me, like your docs are still all over the place. And I'm like, I am sorry. I've learned a lot since then, but the code is gone. And that impact, that long-term impact for people is the actual meaningful part for me in open source and communities and being able to just crack that door open for people that are new to the space or just like, I need one more step. I need to know what the next thing is in how this thing works to understand it a little better. We'll open up doors that I'm not going to open all the doors, but I can give them that little piece, hopefully, of breaking down that complex thing in a hopefully understandable way. So they don't have to worry about it anymore. And they can just operate that system and that environment as like something they understand now. And they can give it on to the kids and the next person and the people they interact with.
I mean, I can't think of a better way to start to wrap up the conversation. Like, I mean, that all of that, at least in my opinion, singularly defines like why a lot of us do the things that we do in tech, right? Because, you know, the cliches are, you know, saying the ladder back down or standing on the shoulders of giants, like all these kind of cliches that exist, they exist for a reason, solely because tech, I'm honestly, I'm in the middle of putting together a talk that says, when did tech become hard? And it's like the idea is like talking about how, you know, you think about the problems have not really changed over the course of in the last 30 years of tech. The problems are all the same, but the tools are becoming more and more challenging. It's becoming harder and harder to figure out where to go and how to get started. And I, without people that are building content, doing trainings, speaking at conferences. Without those people, like, this barrier to entry is just, it's getting to the point, in my opinion, where it's getting way too high. And I'm glad that there are people like you out there that are trying to just make it more accessible, make it more approachable, and also show us, like, hey, like, look at where I'm from. Like, I didn't learn this technology thing when I was six, right? Like, I started in college, and I've gotten to this point where I've learned enough in the time that I've been in tech that I can give back. And I think that's, like, an amazing place to be. And I think that the more people that we have that do that, like, the better off the next generation of tech is, right? And it's been great chatting with you for this hour. I want to get your thoughts on this one last little bit. Like, you know, if you could think about the, you know, your career in tech, and we've been talking about hour about, you know, your upbringing and when you got introduced to it, and all the way to, like, now I'm at the point where I can contribute back to those people that were, like, Justin 15, 20 years ago. You know, what do you think? Like, what are some words that come to mind when you think about those sort of things?
I think about the people that impacted me to be able to get into this area. Like, I had to have a push to be able to, you know, go to college and learn physics. And I had to find out what I found interesting. And one of my, like, tenets for creating at least content that's hopefully widely available is a quote from Walt Disney, where he says, "I would rather entertain you and hope that you learn something than educate you and hope you were entertained." I much more want to focus on the entertainment, because I'm going to bring more people to the table by just telling you this is fun. And if you have fun on the internet, other people will want to come have fun too. And we've been spending so much time gatekeeping and saying, like, this is hard because it's hard because it's hard. And it has to be. And it's like, actually, let's just make it a little bit entertaining. And you can learn a little bit at a time. It might take you longer than reading a book, but you're going to love it a lot more. And if we can go down that route of making that just more accessible to more people, the technology is going to swing back, because people that are new to it aren't going to put up with the nonsense things that are difficult because we just made them difficult a while ago and never thought about changing it. They're going to say, actually, this doesn't have to be hard. I can make that easy. And if I can make it easy, then the next person can make it complicated again. Sure. And then we can go back and forth on this cycle. And as we get more and more new people and we open the door to allow them to come in, we can make that pendulum swing back to say, like, actually, technology, maybe it wasn't easy, but it was understandable. Smaller systems are understandable for a lot of people. And if you can understand all the components and how they interact with each other, then you can add your own complications on top of it. And the most, like, you know, the cheapest infrastructure and website you can run is, like, the desktop under your desk, like the computer under your desk. You can run a website on it. People don't understand that. Like, your computer is connected to the internet. You can open a port and you can run a website. And if you can understand how your computer can run a website, you might be able to understand how you can load balance it too. Yeah. And then you might be able to understand how you can containerize it. And you can understand how, like, all of these things just build on each other by just starting from what is the simplest thing that I can understand. And that can be uncomplicated. I'm not going to say it's easy. I'm not going to say it's simple, but at least we can take away some of the complications or the visible complications of the interface. The CPU processor, the Linux kernel, the firewall, all that stuff is still complicated, just like under the engine, the hood of my car. But my interface is a steering wheel and a pedal, and I can just go. And I can figure out how to get to the store based on some street signs. And people can find their own path by showing them the interface that is easy enough to use that they can go make their own destiny with it.
I'm fired up now. I mean, that was good. That was really good. Man, I'm fired up. I mean, this has been great, Justin. I really appreciate it. If you're not following Justin on social media, or just, you know, paying attention to the things on TikTok, the things, you know, just the content that he's creating, I highly recommend you can reach out to him. I follow him on Twitter. Rothgar, Rothgar. I hope that's right. Right. Is that pronounced right?
Yep.
Yeah. There's also be some links to some other ways that you can follow him and find out what he's doing. This has been great. I mean, before we sign off, do you have anything else to say?
No, I mean, I think it's, I love how open source has changed and grown over time.
Yeah.
And the open source that is today in 2024 is not the open source that I started getting involved with in 2004. And those sorts of things should change over time. And I love seeing where people are taking it and how they're making it their own. And so, yeah, like absolutely. If people want to reach out, I'm accessible a lot of places and would love to see what they're learning and understand from them the things that used to be difficult that now they understand and they just take for granted. Because those are the things that I think we constantly take for granted. And it's hard to then pass that to someone else because we're just like, I understand it. Why can't you? It's like, actually, no, these things are difficult to understand. And let's break it down in a way that's meaningful for that person to understand it better.
This is great. I really appreciate the time here. This is like, I got a lot out of this conversation. I hope the folks that were watching this live and folks that are listening in the future, you got as well. I hope that everybody here has a great day. Thank you so much for listening. This is Isaac Levin from Coffee and Open Source. For my new friend, Justin Garrison, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. Take care.